This is Edward October. It's Sunday morning, and I'm here at a typical American home. But inside, Jen and Cam of our True Crime podcast sit down to record their latest episode. Though Jen and Cam are lifelong friends, they approach true crime with the utmost professionalism. They're focused.
So, a deer.
Highly articulate.
Alachua, is that how you say it?
Alachua, like Joshua, but Alachua.
Alachua.
You will Alachua onto my...
And above all, compassionate.
Honestly, I debated if I wanted to do this. And in the end, I decided it was important to honor this baby's short life.
Every day, more folks wake up hungry for a true crime podcast. And our true crime podcast is enjoyed best by more people. So whenever you're downloading any podcast of any kind, be sure to download an extra episode of our True Crime Podcast. You'll like them. Available on all your favorite podcatchers or at ourtruecrimepodcast.com.
See this? The mouth? It gets me in trouble.
This is a homicide.
That force was train wreck force. My son was beat to death.
That is how I remember seeing Dennis all the time.
Warning, this podcast contains explicit details of child abuse that listeners will find offensive. Listener discretion is freely advised. Welcome to Crime Laps. I am Eileen. This week I have some help. Say hello, Charlie.
Hello.
This is Through the White Picket Fence, the murder of Dennis Jurgens. On December 6, 1961, a 17-year-old unwed mother, a ward of the state, gave birth while living in a school for girls. She was forced to give the baby up for adoption, hoping that one day they would meet again. Years later, when she began searching for her son, she discovered he had died, aged just 3.5. The search for her lost child ended almost as soon as it began, but her search for justice had only just started. Jerry Sherwood was committed to Sauk Centre Reform School at age 14, after a troublesome childhood. Her mother had left when she was young and she was brought up by her father. She suffered abuse at the hands of two stepmothers and rebelled. After getting into trouble as a young teen, she was placed into a foster home, and when it didn't work out, she was sent to Sauk Centre. It was in a foster home in St. Cloud that Jerry met Dennis McIntyre. The couple were wildly in love, and when Jerry's foster parents found out she was sexually active, they sent her back to the reform school. She was already 2 months pregnant. In December, she gave birth to a little boy she named Dennis. Jerry was forced into placing him up for adoption. During the short time she had with Dennis, Jerry had him baptized like his father. Dennis was then taken away, and 4 months later, Jerry was brought to court to sign away her parental rights. She trusted that the system would take care of him, and when he was old enough to reach out to her, he would. Jerry went on to marry and have 4 more children with Dennis's father. 3 girls and a boy. Misty, Rhonda, Dawn, and a son they also called Dennis. She always held out hope she would meet her firstborn son again. Every year on the 6th of December, Jerry would sing happy birthday and long for her child. In 1970, Jerry and Dennis Sr. divorced. Jerry worked odd jobs and remarried, but that marriage also ended not long after. After Dennis's birthday each year, she would fall into a depression. In the early 80s, when her son reached the age of adulthood, she decided to reach out and try to find him. After calling Scott County Welfare Department in an effort to locate Dennis, a letter arrived. It arrived from Ramsey County. Nervous and apprehensive that Dennis could have possibly rejected her, she opened the letter.
I called Scott County Welfare Department. Approximately 6 weeks later, I get a letter in the mail. Sorry to inform you, Dennis Craig Jurgens died April 11th of 1965 of peritonitis. Sincerely.
Peritonitis is an inflammation of the membrane lining the abdominal cavity. He also had a ruptured bowel. All those years that Jerry had grieved for her son, she didn't know that she was grieving for a dead child. She was devastated. A few days later, Jerry rang Ramsey County to try and find out some more information about Dennis and what happened to him. They told her his adoptive surname and where he was buried. Dennis Jurgens was buried in St. Mary's Cemetery in 1965. 2 months later, Jerry went to the graveyard, accompanied by her daughter and a friend. They walked the rows of graves looking for Dennis's name, but couldn't find it. They found a little building where the mortician Jim Honsa was working. Jim knew immediately who they were asking about. Even after working there for 20 years, he couldn't forget little Dennis Jurgens. Jim gave Jerry a file. Attached to it was an old newspaper clipping dated April 13, 1965. It was a short article titled, Tot's Death Due to Peritonitis. It read, quote, "An autopsy on the body of 3.5-year-old Dennis Jurgens, son of Mr. and Mrs. Harold Orr Jurgens, showed he died of peritonitis caused by a ruptured bowel," Dr. Thomas W. Vittel, Ramsey County Coroner, said today. "The body also bore multiple injuries and bruises," Dr. Vittel said. "White Bear Police and the coroner's office are investigating the death," unquote.
And the first thing I did was I looked at my friend and my daughter, my son. I said, my son was beaten to death. I knew it. I felt it.
Jerry immediately knew that her baby's death wasn't an accident. The group left the office and went back out to look for the grave. They spotted a groundskeeper and asked if he knew where Dennis was buried. The man guided them to the spot and told them that Dennis was his nephew. He spoke about how his sister and her husband made sure that Dennis never wanted for anything. He said they were well off, and Dennis's adoptive father was an electrician in a store. When Jerry told him who she was and asked about the bruises, the man walked away. Jerry searched for the Jurgens' contact details, but they were unlisted. She pretended to be a family friend and rang the store where Dennis's adoptive father worked, asking for their home number. Jerry rang the number, and Lois Jurgens answered the phone. Lois said she thought Jerry had been informed about Dennis's death a long time before. Jerry said, quote, "I asked her what kind of little boy he was, and she said he had been a good, happy little boy. She didn't say much else except that when he was found, he had black blotches all over his body, and they didn't know where the wounds had come from. I told her I dearly wanted a picture of him, and she promised to send me one, along with a baptismal sweater. I gave her my name, phone number, and address, and I waited about 6 weeks and didn't get anything," unquote. When Jerry tried to call again, the number had been changed and their new number was unlisted. Feeling defeated, Jerry said, quote, "I just kind of dropped it. Everybody said I had given up my legal rights," unquote.
Lois Jurgens was from a large family. She had 15 siblings. She grew up poor, and when she married middle-class Howard Jurgens, her life changed. Lois was desperate to appear like the perfect housewife. She had a pathological need to control everything in her life, but she could not control herself. In the 1950s, Lois suffered with her mental health. She had various mental illnesses and was institutionalized. Whilst in a psychiatric hospital, she was administered electroconvulsive therapy. She was not able to conceive children, and this drove her into a deeper depression. Lois was a woman who exercised control in all aspects of her life, and one huge part was taken out of her control in no uncertain terms when she was told she was unable to have children of her own. That control was again taken away when they were unable to adopt children through the usual channels. Lois and Harold were blocked from adopting children because of Lois's history of mental illness, but somehow they managed to privately adopt a baby boy. They named him Robert. Adopting a baby privately was a way to regain that control for Lois. When the state authorities found out, they weren't pleased that the Jurgens had gone through unofficial channels, but seeing how well Robert was doing, they allowed the Jurgens to adopt another little boy on December 7, 1962. The Jurgens had two criteria for a potential child. They must be an infant and they must be Catholic. The little boy was exactly 1 year and 1 day old. His birth mother had baptized him and named him after his biological father, Dennis. Lois complained about the way Dennis looked. She said the little boy was, quote, "awful looking," unquote, and that his feet were too big and he was fat. A one-year-old child. Lois had concerns about how Dennis would relate to their older son, Robert. but her husband Harold was more than happy to adopt him. Lois must have had a fixed image of what her ideal life would look like, and anything that would jeopardize that needed to change. In her mind, when Dennis came along and she saw him as awful and fat, she didn't see him as a one-year-old child. She saw him simply as a jigsaw piece she needed to make fit into the puzzle that was her life. And she would stop at nothing to make sure that he was made to fit or suffer the consequences. Less than a year later, Dennis, aged just 1.5, was hospitalized with severe burns on his lower abdomen, genitals, and buttocks. The Jurgens told the doctor that it had happened when Dennis turned on the hot water tap while he was in the bath. The extent of Lois's control and influence is evident through her husband and family members, their compliance when they witnessed her abusing her young son. Family members recalled the Jurgens boys being quiet, especially Robert. It was always Dennis that seemed to get into trouble for the smallest of things. When Dennis was learning to walk, Lois would yank him up and hit him on the arm, hard. Lois would tie Dennis's arms and legs to his crib to keep him lying down. And as a punishment for the slightest thing, she would put a clothespin on the tip of his penis and force him to kneel on the handle of a brush and recite the rosary. The Jurgens would tell people that Dennis was unable to feel pain and would thank them for spanking him. This was a folie à deux, a shared delusion passed from Lois to her ever-loyal husband that Dennis could feel no pain and thus justified and excused the relentless abuse he suffered.
On April 11, 1965, Officer Robert Vanderwist responded to a call about a DOA of a small child. At around 9 a.m. that morning, Harold Jurgens called Dr. Roy Peterson and said he believed his son was dying. The Jurgens told police that Dennis had slipped the day before and had a fever from a cold. Harold said that he had taken Dennis to the bathroom in the night and the little boy was in good form, chatting about his father's broken watch. The next morning, when Lois went to check on Dennis, he was gurgling and gasping for air. Their story changed just once. They said Dennis had fallen down the basement stairs a week earlier. The attending doctor, Roy Peterson, pronounced Dennis Jurgens dead at 10 a.m. that morning. Dr. Thomas Vittel was the coroner at the time in 1965. His colleague, Dr. Robert Woodburn, performed the autopsy on Dennis Jurgens shortly after his death. Dr. Vittel said that he believed Dennis was an abused child and marked his cause of death as deferred while he awaited more information about the investigation. Dr. Woodburn said that there had been between 50 to 100 bruises on Dennis's body at the time of his death. There was a linear bruise on Dennis's upper abdomen. During the internal autopsy, he found a perforation of the small bowel that caused gastrointestinal material to seep into the peritoneal cavity, which caused peritonitis, leading to Dennis's death. It's likely that Dennis died after spending days in agonizing pain. The perforation or tear of the small bowel had no internal cause. Dr. Woodburn believed that it had to have been caused by external trauma with force equivalent to a train wreck.
She either had to punch him in the stomach, either with her hand or with an object, with his back up against a hard surface like a floor or a wall in order to push that bowel into his spine and tear it. Or she had to kick him or do something, but he had to be on a flat surface and there had to be some force doing it. And the doctors told us that force was train wreck force.
5 days later, Robert was removed from the Jurgens' home, but no further action was taken. Lois's brother was the second in command in the local police force. The cause of Dennis's death remained deferred. A few years after Jerry Sherwood had discovered that the son she reluctantly placed for adoption had died, she resumed her pursuit for the truth. She sent her son to the library to find all the information he could about Dennis's death and sent her daughter to the courthouse to get Dennis's death certificate. Because the mode of death was listed as deferred, the case was still classed as an open case. There was no statute of limitations on murder, so someone could be prosecuted for the murder of Dennis Jurgens. 21 years after Dennis's death, the case was finally getting attention. J. Jerry took to the White Bear Police Department, where the Chief of Investigations, Lieutenant Clarence Harvey, pulled the file. When they seen the bruises and locations of the injuries, they were shocked. Neither could believe that no one had been charged for murder. Lieutenant Harvey went to the Ramsey County Medical Officer, Dr. Michael McGee, who only needed to glance at the file to know that it wasn't an accident that caused Dennis Jurgens' death.
And he's just covered with bruises. His face is covered with them. He has a large bruise in his forehead region. His abdomen is distended. I said, well, this is a homicide. And I said, you know, we need to find out what's going on.
After 2 decades, the cause of death was changed from deferred to homicide. Jerry went to the press with the story to try and raise the profile of the case. Journalists were eager to speak to Lois Jurgens. After over 20 years, the past was finally catching up to her. The Jurgens had regained custody of Robert in 1969 after moving to Stillwater, Minnesota. In 1972, they were allowed to adopt 4 siblings from Kentucky. 3 years later, the 2 older children ran away and reported Lois for repeatedly abusing and beating them. Lois would come into their rooms in the middle of the night to make sure they were up to her standard of cleanliness. If she found that they had any dust or the slightest bit of disorganization, she would beat them. Harold was not abusive, but he didn't stop Lois either. When she instructed Harold to discipline the children, he would tell them to cry loudly as he slapped his own leg, to convince Lois he was following her orders. The siblings were constantly on edge. The noise of Lois' bedroom door opening or the sight of her car in the garden as they got off the school bus would make their stomachs sink. She was incredibly violent and sadistic. She once held one of the boy's ears and slammed his head onto a nail that was sticking out of the wall. Lois denied the child abuse charges, but consented to having her parental rights stripped.
In January 1987, almost 22 years after he was buried, the remains of Dennis Jurgens were exhumed for examination by the Ramsey County Medical Examiner, Dr. Michael McGee. He had changed the death certificate in October 1986 to homicide, but he wanted clear evidence. Dennis's body was incredibly well preserved. He still wore the crown of flowers placed on his head to conceal bruises when he was first buried, although they had wilted.
I worked straight through the day and into the evening hours, and about 2:30 in the morning of the following morning, I had found the bowel. And in the mid-portion of the bowel, there is a defect present. That was the defect that caused the bowel to spill contents into his cavity and the cause of death in the child.
Dr. McGee was able to re-examine the small bowel and said that the perforation was caused by blunt force trauma about 8 to 48 hours before Dennis died. There was no way the injury could have been caused by a fall unless it was from at least 6 feet directly onto a protruding object. Dr. McGee believed the trauma was likely to have been to Dennis's stomach.
Children can certainly fall down and receive injuries. There's no question about that. But Dennis's injuries, you must understand, were delivered to deep-set organs inside of his body, the bowel. The injuries we're talking about requires tremendous energy. And aside from automobile accidents or accidents of that nature, a child simply cannot generate that much energy just falling down the stairs or slipping on a wet bathroom floor.
The 3-year-old boy would have likely been standing or lying with his back against a flat surface while something with the force of a train wreck hit his stomach, forcing a small bowel against his spine and tearing it. The contents of the bowel would have been spilled into his stomach, causing agonizing pain and eventual death. The assistant county attorneys assigned to the case were Melinda Elledge and Clayton Robinson Jr. Melinda Elledge was adopted herself, and she had a son the same age as Dennis had been when he died. They weren't experienced in murder cases, but they were passionate about getting justice for Dennis Jurgens after all these years. Detective Greg Kindle, a specialist in juvenile abuse crimes, and Detective Ron Meehan were assigned the case after a memo was sent to all police personnel in the White Bear Department. They knew that Lois would never confess, so they tracked down the original detective from 1965. Former Officer Vanderwist told them that there was a lot missing from the files, including testimonies from family members who believe Lois was abusive. They did not need to look far, because soon people were coming forward to finally tell the truth about the type of person Lois really was. The stories they told were heartbreaking. Dennis was force-fed food and vomit. He was slapped and yanked by the ears and had his head held underwater until he gasped for air. Lois had come from a large family, and they stuck together. They would meet up every week in their parents' home with their own families, but most of Lois's family did not like her. They said she was nasty, brittle, controlling, and demanding. She didn't let her kids be kids, they weren't allowed to take treats from anyone, and they were forbidden from getting dirty or playing. Lois would act like a devout Catholic, although she rarely went to church. Some recalled her walking around with a cross raised above her head trying to drive out the devil. Others remembered her flashing her bare breasts to a room full of people. She was unhinged, but they felt like it was none of their business. In under 2 years, Dennis had gone from a bubbly social child to a frightened, lonely little boy. He even stopped crying, instead just whimpering, afraid to draw more attention to himself. Some had asked Lois why, if she hated Dennis so much, why didn't she give him back to the authorities? She answered that they would not let her adopt any more children if she did. People were afraid to tell the truth after Dennis died. It was clear at the funeral that most of the mourners knew that something wasn't right about Dennis's death. Those that did speak out reported that they had received threats. Lois called them late at night for weeks, claiming she would burn down their houses and kill their children.
The detectives reached out to Robert, the Jurgens' first child, Dennis's big brother. After thinking about what to do for weeks, Robert decided he would tell them everything he knew. He would testify against his mother. In October 1986, the detectives met with Robert Jurgens. When he saw the autopsy photos of Dennis's beaten body, he hardly flinched. He said, quote, "Dennis always looked like that," unquote. There was a year and a half between Robert and Dennis, and a world of difference in how they were treated. Robert had been quiet, timid, and complacent, and even as an infant, he learned not to upset his mother. Dennis was more spirited, and Lois resented him from the start.
She'd whip you with a belt or a cedar board, and on one occasion that I recall, her grabbing Dennis by the back of the ears and forcefully submerged his head under the water. And I remember him gasping as he would come up for air and crying.
After Dennis was killed, Robert was taken away from the Jurgens for 4 years. Marion Dina Nord, a social worker for Ramsey County, later spoke of how she opposed the Jurgens' attempts to regain custody of Robert. But she had been discouraged from looking into Dennis's death and told that the file was missing. Doctors testified that Lois was fit to look after Robert, and so he was returned to her care just before he turned 10. 3 years later, they adopted the siblings from Kentucky after using their stature and wealth to obtain custody of them from a private agency, Lutheran Social Services. A few years later, after the children were removed from their home after allegations of abuse were filed, Robert, then a teenager, began running away from home. After several instances, he was placed in a foster home, and from the age of 15, developed a drug addiction. Robert was hospitalized and subsequently broke that addiction. He remained close to his parents, and his relationship with them got better as he grew up. He became a police officer and had a family of his own. He married a paralegal when he was 21 and had a son. At the time he was interviewed by police, his son was the same age Dennis had been when he was killed. After the investigation reopened and he started to hear more about his little brother's death, he was torn between his duty as a police officer and his loyalty to his parents. He tried to speak about it with his parents, but they wouldn't talk about it. Eventually, he told the White Bear detectives that he knew what happened to Dennis all those years before. He told them everything about how his mother killed Dennis.
Lois Jurgens was indicted on January 29th, 1987. She was charged with one count of second-degree murder and 2 counts of third-degree murder. Jerry Sherwood was finally getting justice for her son, but now all she could do was watch from the courtroom gallery when Lois, then in her 60s, was arraigned the following day. It had been 21 years, 9 months and 19 days since Dennis's death. Lois Jurgens pleaded not guilty to the charges. There was no record of the original hearing about Dennis's death from 1965. The records were nowhere to be found. Until the day before the trial, which began on the 12th of May, 1987. There were numerous witnesses who were willing to testify against Lois Jurgens, finally. A poster-sized photo of Dennis's lifeless, battered body was shown to the court. The jurors cried, and Jerry Sherwood had to leave the room. Robert took the stand and said, quote, "Dennis used to cry, try to get away. Later on, Dennis didn't do as much crying, and he didn't do any running away. I would recall that he more or less submitted and would just kind of whimper and not get into that heavy crying. I don't know exactly the reason why, but I cherish my mother. I did everything she said. I ate my food. I picked up my toys. I kept neat and Dennis didn't. And as a result, Dennis received more traumatic reprimands." Unquote. He recalled Lois dunking Dennis's head into a tub of water and said that he was terrified and didn't know what to do. He then told the court about how he saw Dennis rolling down the stairs of the basement after being hit several times by Lois. Lois ran down after him and continued to shout while shaking and hitting him. Speaking about the night Dennis died, he told of how he remembered walking to Dennis's room after hearing Lois crying out his name. Dennis was limp in her arms as she shook him and slapped his back. She then put Dennis back into his cot and called for Harold. In the original autopsy performed in 1965, the coroner found over 50 bruises on Dennis's body. There was also evidence of starvation, scarring from old injuries, and bite marks on his genitals. Dr. McGee, who had changed the death certificate to show the cause of death was homicide, and who subsequently performed an autopsy on the exhumed body of Dennis Jurgens, testified at the trial. He reiterated that the injuries that caused Dennis's death could not have been caused from a fall, but a deliberate blow to the abdomen, which caused his small bowel to rupture. Dr. Sterner, an expert in pediatric forensic pathology, also testified that the fatal injury was caused by an external trauma, likely to the mid-abdomen. The defense presented 2 witnesses to support that Lois Jurgens was mentally ill. Clinical psychologist who had treated Lois in 1967 testified that he believed she had been suffering from paranoid schizophrenia at the time of Dennis's death. A psychiatrist also backed this up, saying she was delusional in her belief that Dennis did not feel pain. The state presented the expert testimony of a court-appointed psychiatrist, Dr. Erickson, who did not believe that Lois was psychotic when she killed Dennis. And even if she had been a paranoid schizophrenic, she would have known what she was doing was wrong. The jury took just 3 hours to reach a unanimous verdict. Lois Jurgens was found not guilty to murder in the second degree, but guilty to murder in the third degree. Under 1965 law, Lois Jurgens was sentenced to an indeterminate sentence up to 25 years and remanded to the Women's Correctional Facility.
Jerry Sherwood finally got some justice for the little boy she loved and lost. After Lois was sentenced, Jerry said, quote, 25 years. Dennis would be 25 years old in December, and she got 25 years, unquote. Lois appealed the decision, saying that the delay gave the prosecution an advantage. The appeal was denied. Lois Jurgens served just 8 years in prison. She was released in 1995 and returned home to her husband, Harold. Harold died 5 years later, and there has been some speculation that Lois poisoned him. But after police investigations, this was unproven. Lois died in 2013, never admitting what she had done. There have been adaptations of this case for TV, film, and books. most notably A Death in White Bear Lake by Barry Siegel and the NBC television film A Child Lost Forever. Jerry Sherwood and her son were let down time and time again throughout both of their lives. She was promised that Dennis would be better off with someone else, and trusted that when he was old enough, they would meet again. She said, quote, "When they took him from me, they said he would have a home, a family, all the things I couldn't give him," unquote. Dennis was allowed to go into the home of someone the state should have known was not capable of providing a safe or loving home for a child. Although some people did try to report Lois for abuse, not enough was done to stop her murdering a three-year-old child. In 1965, it seemed unthinkable that a white, middle-class religious mother would murder her child. We know better. So many people knew what Lois Jurgens was capable of and how she treated Dennis. Others were too concerned with minding their own business. Child abuse is everyone's business. Robert Jurgens said, "Why did this happen? That's the question that doesn't get talked about. I guess it happened because no one wanted to go through the white picket fence of the Jurgens house and step on toes. They just did not want to walk through that white picket fence." Thank you for listening to this episode. Please be sure to follow Crime Lapse on social media. And if you feel like it, maybe become a Patreon. We have some stuff coming there in the next few weeks that I'm pretty excited about. Stay home, stay safe.
Announcing Mind Over Murder, a new true crime podcast.
You're listening to the Mind Over Murder podcast.
My name is Bill Thomas. I'm a writer, consulting producer, and now podcaster. I am now trying to use my experience as the brother of a murder victim to help other victims of violent crime. I'm working on a book on the unsolved Colonial Parkway murders, and I'm the co-administrator of the Colonial Parkway Murders Facebook group together with Kristen Dilley.
My name is Kristen Dilley. I'm a writer, a researcher, a teacher, and a victim's advocate, as well as the social media manager and co-administrator for the Colonial Parkway Murders Facebook page with my partner in crime, Bill Thomas.
Join us each week as we explore new true crime cases, as well as introduce you to experts from a variety of fields in the true crime space.
You're listening to the Mind Over Murder podcast.
Available on your favorite podcast platform.